Most people have a difficult time with Zen practice, and there's a number of possible reasons. I think, is when the initial excitement diminishes, when the initial curiosity dies down, interest is lost. Or if people come to a place and they come to some Zen group or some Zen center, and the teacher there doesn't meet their expectations. Whatever image they had in mind, and they go to some place, and the teacher is not enough charisma or something. So that's another reason why people will have a hard time with practice. Another one, of course, is something or someone very attractive appears, something more attractive than practice, and so interest goes in another direction. So there's a number of these kinds of reasons that can make getting involved in Zen practice, to really get involved in it, a number of reasons can make it kind of difficult, especially, you know, in the busy world we live in, with many activities competing for our attention. But there's a bigger obstacle than those three. It's a greater obstacle that gets in the way, that makes the practice a bit difficult. And that is not understanding the key point of Buddhism, the key point of Buddhist teaching, not understanding the key vision of Buddhism, which is simply that enlightenment is inherent in each of us. Enlightenment is innate in each person. When we don't have just a small sense of that, just an inkling of that, then the practice becomes very difficult. So when we have a sense that enlightenment is already inherent, then we can understand that it is our own personal effort that is the basis of our spirituality, that is the basis of our understanding. That our spirituality is not some kind of gift of grace. Our spiritual feeling is not given to us by the grace of some external deity. But without this understanding, we will come to feel that there is no progress in my practice. We look for progress and we say, oh, I don't see any progress. And so discouragement appears. So really the main obstacle, the problem with that makes Zen practice difficult, is that cannot accept who we are. We don't realize it, or we won't allow it. This is an interesting phenomenon. We will not allow ourselves to acknowledge who we really are, which of course is based on our spiritual nature. So it's always useful to remember the story of the Buddha's early efforts to recall what the Buddha saw at the time of his awakening, time of his enlightenment. You know, and not what he saw with his eyes, but what he saw with his clear mind. We should remind ourselves of that story, which is that after many years of very strict ascetic practice, he gave it up. He gave up the physical rigors of the strict practice, and he simply sat down under the Bodhi tree, and he stopped all that striving. He just sat down. And he is trusted in himself. He recognized in some way that all of these techniques that he had been trying, they don't amount to anything. It was his own personal effort that was important. Who he was inherently that was important. So he sat down under the tree and he sat in meditation for the whole night. And in the morning, he had a realization that everything is Buddha. Everything has Buddha nature. That's what he said. So there is literature, a great deal of literature, from scholars all over the world, lots of literature describing how he then understood the transient nature of everything, and how he recalled his past lives and the karma created in his past lives, and how he saw that there isn't anything that has a permanent self. So through his effort, he saw all this through his sitting down quietly under the tree and stopping his strict ascetic practices and letting his active mind come to rest. He saw clearly who he was and what everything is. And out of his vision, of course, flowed many teachings. Volumes and volumes of sutras and stories came from his vision. And he saw mainly how people create their own suffering. And he saw how people can be relieved of suffering. But the most important thing for us is his very first teaching, and that is that everyone has Buddha nature. That's the starting point. And there's really nothing to elaborate past that. Although there, for centuries, people have been elaborating. There really is nothing to elaborate past that. Everything is Buddha nature. In other words, it means that, simply speaking, everything and everyone is sacred. Not sacred in the biblical sense, with special, mysterious characteristics, but sacred, everything is sacred, and which means to be taken care of. No differentiation. Everything is sacred. Or, another way, everything is in God. And in one of his talks, he said, Everybody talks about God, but nobody really understands what God is. If we remember his first teaching and trust it, that everything is Buddha nature, this is the best motivation for practice. See, in the major religions of the world, in Christianity, Judaism, Islam, belief is that there is a separate God, an external God. And this is the tradition in the Western world for centuries. So it's very hard for Western cultures to accept this idea of not separate, that the so-called deity is us, not separate. We are what? Everything is contained right here, not separate. It's very difficult to accept. I think it must feel sinful to a devout Christian or Jewish person. It must feel heretical to hear, well, God is not separate. So that makes it difficult for us to appreciate Zen practice, which says that not separate. But this is the foundation of spiritual practice. The understanding that there is no separate deity that runs our life, that brings us grace. We provide grace ourselves through our activity, through our action, through our words. We bring grace to our life and to the lives of others. It's our job, not the responsibility of somebody separate from us. So when you dive into Buddhist teachings, and there's a lot, they're very deep, and there's a lot to dive into, it's beyond comprehension. If we don't trust in who we are, it doesn't make sense, the teachings. If we don't trust in who we are, and you can feel that in your own reading. If you read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi's book, if you read it, you can't understand it if you don't have Zazen practice. You can't comprehend it intellectually or understand it logically. But if you sit, you can feel the wisdom in it. So we can understand the teachings only when we ourselves practice. Practice is first. And as when we continue our practice, the trust that we have in who we are will increase. And the recognition of this truth becomes more and more clear as we practice. So when we get confused in our practice, if we feel that, well, we don't know what we're doing or where we are going, it's important to remind ourselves of who we are to remind ourselves of the very first teaching Buddha. Everyone, everything has Buddha nature. And at the same time, nobody, none of us, no, there's nothing that's particularly special. So the Zen practice that we embrace is not about attaining something. It's not about attaining wisdom or attaining enlightenment or anything like that. When we have a picture in our mind of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree in quiet meditation, not striving for anything, when we have that same attitude, we have the same experience as the Buddha. And we will be able to express our true nature, which has already been there. Even though we may not feel like it, don't feel like Buddha. Even though sometimes you don't feel like it, you are actually expressing your true nature when you do this practice. In other words, we don't talk so much about Buddhism or Zen. We don't talk so much about our practice. We let our true nature do the talking about Buddhism. So most of you know the story of Bodhidharma, who went from India to China a long time ago, and his first disciple was Eka. Eka very much wanted to be Bodhidharma's student, and Bodhidharma kept pushing him away. And Bodhidharma said to Eka, "If you want to enter our practice, cut off the self from outward objects and stop emotional and thinking activity. And when you become like a stone wall, you will enter our practice." Well, Eka was very confused by this. It made no sense. Become like a stone wall? He was very confused, and he went away. He left Bodhidharma. But after some time of continuing his practice, he said, "The stone wall is Buddha nature. Everything is the expression of Buddha nature. Now I understand the meaning of Buddha nature. Our innate, inherent true nature, which is universal, shared with everyone, and the only way to understand the truth of things, the truth of our life, is to know who we are in the widest, very widest sense, very widest sense." And nobody can explain it to us. And you can. And nobody could explain it to us, and we can't explain it to anyone. It is difficult to explain who we are inherently. You can't explain it. All that we can say is, it is someone who is practicing continuously, without a break. That's who I am, we say. Who are you? What is your true nature? Just something practicing continuously, with no beginning, no end. So our everyday practice is that way, should be that way, continuously practicing. And it is not a matter of having a good practice or a so-called bad practice. There's no need to judge our practice or to judge anybody else's practice. Good, bad, bad. And it is not necessary for this practice to be purposely difficult. It will have its own difficulties inherently. We don't have to make it difficult. So to find the spirit of our practice and the actual truth of our true nature, we practice without judging. There is no good or bad, no hard or easy. We just do what we do in the moment, without putting it on a scale of 1 to 10. So we sit with some understanding, or at least trust in who we are, with conviction in our true nature. The very first thing, the very first teaching of Buddha, everything is Buddha nature. We trust that. And we practice with that. And if we can maintain this trust, we will find understanding, and we will find wisdom, and we will develop very warm feelings for each other. And warm, the same understanding and wisdom and warm feelings of the greatest of teachers. So the important point is not to be distracted by doubting, not to waste our time by doubting. We have to let our practice continue without a break. So when you have a feeling that you practice, something impels you or compels you to practice, it is your true nature urging you to practice. It's not your emotions. It's not somebody else. It's your nature urging you to practice. That is a blessing. That feeling of the expression of your true nature urging you to practice. So when you feel it, you should trust it and practice and set aside all doubts or all hesitation. So it is important to let our practice be natural, like the flow of a river that continues. Sometimes we may feel a bit discouraged or tired or full of doubts, and we have to force ourselves to come and sit, to force ourselves to get up. If we feel like we have to force ourselves, it's because we momentarily forgot who we are. And so it makes us feel impatient and want to quit. But there is something that is telling you, you should practice, I should practice. So we continue, even when we have doubts and impatience. Because something is saying, you should practice. And we trust that voice. So it's necessary for us, each of us, to return to Buddha's practice, which is give up all ideas about it and just sit. And give up caring about attaining anything from our effort. So what we're doing in this very busy world that is competing for our attention all the time, what we're doing is letting patience replace impatience. And you may find that in your own practice. Let patience replace impatience and extend that attitude to everything. And we let our ideas, desires of attainment be replaced by feeling of no need to attain anything. That brings us a very confident and peaceful feeling. No anxiety. Then we find confidence in ourselves and understand who we are in a large sense. So we have to be careful of avoiding having any idea that we will become something special if we practice, or we will improve ourselves if we practice. That's a very attractive idea. So we have to be careful not to be caught by that. If we ever have an opportunity to go into space, if we were to see the Earth from a great distance, we would feel how wonderful. We would see it and say, how beautiful, how wonderful. And we want to take a photo of it. But the Earth itself has no such feeling about its wonderfulness. The Earth is simply moving and continuing its practice. But we see it from a distance, we say it's wonderful. And when we have that kind of glimpse or vision, when we come back down to Earth, we will just continue our practice, just like the Earth. So we should let our lives be that way. If we see something wonderful from a distance, when we feel inspired, then we should practice just like the beauty that we see. So we should let our lives be like that. practicing completely with the life that we have. And sometimes we may feel, oh, it's wonderful. Sometimes not. Makes no difference. Makes no difference. We go beyond that. So, we shouldn't be bothered. We should try not to be bothered by something that we feel or what other people say. We try not to be bothered by those things. We may start practice without understanding who we are. But it is who we are that is urging us to practice. At first, when we first come to practice, the small mind does not understand the big mind. But the big mind is encouraging small mind. And that's where we can put our trust. In the midst of doubts, confusion, big mind is encouraging our small mind to practice. So we go ahead with that understanding and that determination. Does anyone have a question? Yes, please.
I think this question is kind of intellectual and probably goes against all of what you said today, which is just said. But whatever books I read, there are like three concepts. Buddhist concepts, which are, I feel there's a relationship, but I cannot figure out the relationship. And there probably is a relationship. So there's this concept of big mind, and there's a concept of emptiness, and there's a concept of the other show. So I feel there is some relationship, but I'm probably okay with understanding this in future. I'm in no hurry to get the understanding, but if there is explanation, that would be good too, I feel, because I'll stop worrying about this. But I feel there is some relationship between these three concepts. Like, the other show seems like it's a place, perhaps not geographically, perhaps in a consciousness or something. So maybe that's related to big mind, and there is this emptiness, but I don't understand how emptiness relates to big mind. But these three concepts, I mean, people talk about it. Sometimes when I read a book like Bodhidharma book, I really liked it because it was short, and after reading the book, things were very clear to me for some time, and then the clarity disappeared. So these concepts, I have no. These concepts trouble me a bit because they seem different, but they must be related.
To understand relationship, best thing to do is not think about them and just practice. If you think about these concepts and ideas, it's just then the practice becomes an intellectual exercise. So you can just put those aside and just sit and trust the sitting. Let big mind appear. Let emptiness show itself. And don't worry about some other shore. Just sit. Thank you. Victor.
You mentioned no permanent self, and those words I don't really understand what that means. Is there a temporary self?
When we look carefully at ourselves and the world around us, if we look very carefully, we see that everything is changing in every moment. Nothing is permanent, including the mountain that looks like it's been that way for a zillion years and will always be that way. But everything is constantly changing. So nothing has what you call permanency, although it seems like it.
So not even for a few seconds. When you say everything continuously changing, so there's nothing you can say, oh, that thing exists for a moment. Is that what you're saying? When you say impermanence.
When we recognize that we are not permanent, even for 5 minutes, when we recognize that we are continually changing and transient, like incense smoke, the burning incense, you know, we're like that, constantly changing. When we can feel ourselves like that incense, then there's no risk of developing any kind of arrogance or ego. It's when we feel that we are a permanent fixed self that we develop these ideas. So as we are sitting here right now, each one of us is changing, getting older. Our skin is sagging a little bit. Everything about us, physically and emotionally and permanently, is in constant motion. When we can feel that quality of ourself, we have no more problems. Everything changes. Doesn't stay the same even for 1 second. Thank you. Yes, Richard.
You mentioned earlier about major theistic religions, Christian, Judaism, and Islam, that,
yes,
that have like an external God, or and how Buddhism is different because it's, we trust the within. But within each of those traditions, they have like an inner esoteric tradition. There's, you know, Christian mystics, and there's Sufis, and they are generally considered heretical. A lot of them have been stamped out and or ignored. But I guess it's threatening to the monotheistic religions to have people trusting something within. Do you think that our practice, Buddhism in general, is compatible with the more esoteric religions, the more like inner traditions, even, you know, that each culture has their own version of that? Or in other ways, do we have something to learn or teach, or like some compatibility with those other traditions?
What do you mean? What does esoteric mean?
Well, just like more focused on like the God within, like an inner focus, rather than seeing religion as an exterior, like a hierarchical thing. I don't know, that's my understanding. Mm-hmm. I've been like studying this kind of thing lately. It's interesting. It's hard to describe it now. So it has that in common with Buddhism. It's hard to describe.
I think esoteric practices are ways that people have devised to be in touch with their essential self, like the Sufis do Sufi dancing, and they kind of lose themselves in an effort to really to touch who they are without thinking about it or projecting an image, or projecting an idea on something external. Those practices, I believe, my understanding is, the esoteric practices are ways to try to break down the everyday mind and the trap of thinking. The trap that thinking puts us in. Esoteric practices are a way to, you know, stop that. so in that way, they may have something in common with this practice. If my understanding of the esoteric is partially, even partially correct. Thank you. Oh, yes, Carolina.
During service, every other Saturday morning, we chant the Enme Juku Kano Nyo for protecting life. And so we just do that. It's practice. And do you care to say anything about it, or we just do it?
We just do it. As a courtesy, as an acknowledgement to the people and the culture and tradition that gave us this practice. On Saturday mornings we do chant, we have some chants that are in Japanese, and we continue them, we do them, because this practice is a gift from that tradition. And so, to maintain a connection and a feeling with that tradition, we chant some things that they chant, even though we have the foggiest idea of what we're saying. But we do it out of courtesy and out of respect, out of gratitude. So it's like, well, we change some of the forms and some of the practices that we inherited, but we don't want to be so arrogant as to change everything. Mm-hmm. Everything must be American, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't want to fall into that trap, so we, out of courtesy, continue some of those things. And like you say, we just do it.
Just do it. It isn't a call for help.
No, we just do it.
If there is help, we'll take it.
We do it out of respect. Gratitude to the tradition from Asia that made it possible for us to find this practice. That's my feeling. I don't remember anybody, starting in the 1950s, I don't remember anybody discussing why we should do that chant because it brings us some benefit.
Uh-huh.
Nobody's ever said that. They said, let's just do it because it's a sign, it's a gesture of friendship. Uh-huh. That's all. Thank you. Oh, Lee, excuse me.
Yes, that kind of brings to mind a thought that came through my mind as you were talking. I thought of that long poem, the Shinshin Mei, and there's one of the first lines in it is, if you want to have equanimity, just give up having any preferences. Something to that effect, and it's such a shocking statement to me, because when you think of what it means to give up your preferences, it means to give up that that construction that you think of as yourself. You know, I'm the kind of person who does this, or I don't like to do that. And when you're sitting, you're basically allowing that persona to just disperse in a way. And getting to that point where you're not thinking of, oh, I prefer this or I don't prefer that, or I like this and I don't like that, you're allowing something deeper, that deeper self to show itself. So I feel that somehow that that's relating to what you've been telling us and talking to us about tonight.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's it. That's a beautiful poem. And once you read the first line, like you just recited, you don't have to read anymore. Does anybody recognize what Lee is talking about? This poem that came from a Chinese Zen teacher years ago, Xin Xin Ming, it's called. I forgot the translation. English.
Something mind.
Something. Well, anyway, maybe we should bring it here. No, thank you.